Mit Hans-Jürgen Bartsch. Heute On the Genetic Basis of Morphological Evolution von Christiane Nüßlein-Fohlhardt. Donnerstag, liebe Zuhörerinnen und Zuhörer, ist bei uns Nobelpreisträgertag. Diesmal im Programm eine heute 67-jährige Forscherin, der im Fachbereich Biologie weltweite Ehren zuteil geworden sind. Nüßlein-Fohlhardt sprach auf dem Nobelpreisträgertreffen in diesem Jahr in Lindau am Bodensee über das Thema, das Sie gleich bei uns mitverfolgen können. Die Professorin leitet die Abteilung Genetik des Tübinger Max-Planck-Institutes für Entwicklungsbiologie. Von durchschlagendem Ruhm waren ihre Untersuchungen über die genetischen Entwicklungen bei frühen Embryonen, die 1995 mit dem Nobelpreis für Physiologie oder Medizin gewürdigt wurden. Schon als Kind zeigte Nüßlein-Fohlhardt ein überdurchschnittliches Interesse an Tieren und Pflanzen. Mit 12 stand ihr Berufsziel Biologin fest. 1962 studierte sie Biologie in Frankfurt, ab 1964 Biochemie in Tübingen. Das Diplom erhielt sie 1968 und war ab 1969 am Max-Planck-Institut für Virusforschung als wissenschaftliche Mitarbeiterin tätig. 1973 Promotion im Fach Genetik. In der Folge ging sie ans Basler Biozentrum sowie nach Freiburg. 1978 bis 1980 Leiterin der Forschungsgruppe am Europäischen Molekularbiologischen Laboratorium in Heidelberg. Später Nachwuchsgruppenleiterin am Friedrich-Miescher-Laboratorium der Max-Planck-Gesellschaft in Tübingen sowie Direktorin des Max-Planck-Institutes für Entwicklungsbiologie. Sie nahm außerdem verschiedene Lehraufträge in Amerika an. In Tübingen ist sie seit 1991 Honorarprofessorin. Auch gründete sie ein Biotechnologieunternehmen, das sich auf die Entwicklung gentechnisch hergestellter Medikamente spezialisiert hat. Das Referat hielt Christiane Nüßlein-Fohlhardt am 28. Juni dieses Jahres.
I will start with Darwin's traveling around the world, and you know that Darwin did this great journey on the Beagle. Where he went around the world, and I think as a young man, this is the route he took. He came from Plymouth, from England, and then to South America, and then to the Galapagos Islands, and then to New Zealand and Tanzania and Australia, and back via Africa to England. And during the course of this travel, he collected many plants and animals and all sorts of living beings and sent them home. And people described them, and he had an enormous knowledge about all these plants and animals. And this is something really exceptional, and nowadays I think no one of us contemporary biologists have so much knowledge. And this is probably the reason why he could come up with his theory of evolution. And he noted, and this was shortly after he came back to England, he made the first sketches of evolutionary trees, and he noted that there was great that one could see similarities in plants and animals which were very significant, such that one cannot just say, I mean, they were invented from God in a totally independent fashion, but he noticed regularities and similarities, and he deduced from that the idea that there was a common origin of these particular of animals and plants, and that there were they had common principles of organization, and then he wrote this very important book which you probably have not read, which however you definitely should read, and this was published 150 years ago in 1859, and it's called The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. And in this book he described that the similarity of plants and animals go back to a common origin, meaning that they are really they're coming from the same ancestors. And one of the most important arguments for his theory actually was classification, namely something which biologists had noticed long before him, that it was possible to create a natural system of plants and animals, to order them according to similarities and differences. And you know that Linnaeus already in the 18th century had made this natural system where he classified plants, particular plants, but also animals, and they were grouped according to similarities in their body plan and in their organization. And in this chapter 13, he went on and on about the fact that you can classify is already an indication that you have a common origin, a common descent. And he concluded then, and this is a sentence which I quote from his book, "From the first dawn of life, all organic beings are found to resemble each other in descending degrees so that they can be classed in groups under groups. Naturalists try to arrange the species, genera, and families in each class on what is called a natural system." Natural means it should be right. And this is what the scientists knew, that it should be right, but we don't know exactly what it's right. And there were many, you know, that many reorganizations of these classifications have been taking place, because it's not so easy to exactly say which species are closer related than others. "And all true classification is genealogical. Community of descent is the hidden bond which naturalists have been unconsciously seeking, and not some unknown plan of creation, and the mere putting together and separating objects more or less alike." So he deduced this genealogical descent of animals and plants from the similarities, and postulated that they had a common origin. And then he has this one illustration in this book with this evolutionary tree. This is the end point of the tree. So these are now species. These are now recent species which are existing today, which you can sort of group by similarities, but you don't exactly know how they are related to each other. And then he has this wonderful sentence: "If every form which had ever lived on this earth were suddenly to reappear, a natural classification would be possible." And then, and I'll show you the full graph, and there you have this visionary idea of all going back to a common ancestor. And this idea of evolution, of course, at the time was highly controversial, but in the meantime, it has been, of course, widely accepted. What he also noted, and this was in this chapter which I showed you before, is that, and this had been also noted by other biologists, and they didn't interpret it right, they didn't know what it meant, but they observed that the earlier the stage in an animal life, the more closely related they look. So the classical example, which came from Carl Ernst von Baer already in 1823 or so, he observed that when you have embryos, and they had these preparations of embryos in formalin or so, and you couldn't really distinguish a dog from a horse because they looked so very similar. And Darwin concluded from this similarity in the embryos that this was the stage where you could classify them best. You can say all those which look very similar, they must be related. But later, in later development, they look widely different. So, for example, a bat looks very different from a dog, but a bat embryo looks very similar to a dog embryo. And he showed in his next book, The Descent of Man, he showed this picture, which is a human embryo compared to a dog embryo. And he made the point that they look very much alike. And this is what he already sort of has touched, that there are big similarities in the early development, but there are quite large differences in later stages of life. And when you look at evolution, I mean, you can use these similarities in embryonic development to classify, but the diversification occurs in later stages, and the selection which Darwin has postulated would be the driving force for evolution. This selection acts on the adult animals and not on the embryos. And the embryos look alike because there is no selection on them. They don't have to defend themselves, they don't have to eat, they don't have to fight, they don't have, the mother protects them, so they don't have to change much. But when they get born, and then there is a lot of, after hatching from the egg, there is a lot of selection, because then they have to thrive alone and they have to survive. And I mean, this means of variation and selection then has led to this immense spreading of, or the diversification of animal phyla. And this is a more recent tree, which I'll explain. Well, I don't really explain to you, but you, and I have alluded this in the answer to your question already, on this common origin of the metazoan, which then radiates, and you have the insects on the one side, and the vertebrates, the chordates, on the other side. And you also see very clearly that the last common ancestor of the insects and the vertebrates is very basic. And so you do expect some fundamental similarities, but you expect also great differences. And I will come back to this. So morphological evolution is based on variation, change of morphology by mutations in genes that determine the shape and the function of the animal, of course. And the selection then acts individuals, which are sort of better adapted to the environmental conditions. They produce, on average, often more progeny, and on long time scale, this would lead to the change of form and those mutations which are beneficial or just helps them to survive are then carried on and others are eliminated. The target for selection are the adult forms, and the embryonic and larval forms are more conserved. Now, in developmental biology and what I have been studying in my career, namely the development of the genetic basis of the development of Drosophila, we focused on the early stages of development. And many genes are now very well known, which are participating in early developmental stages and are involved in building the basic body plans of insects, of nematodes, of vertebrates. However, these genes needn't tell us much about how the variation in form arises later in development, because when you do genetic screens, the genes are already active early in embryogenesis. You cannot get mutations which show you their function in the adult, so they go undetected essentially. And therefore, the genes which are required for diversification of the forms of the adult have not been very well known and not very well studied. And it's predictable that flies do not help us much, because vertebrates are so far apart, well, it's no longer here, but are so far apart from in evolution that maybe the divergence is so much that we cannot use flies as a model for the adult morphology of vertebrates. So we have to directly study vertebrates and genetics of the adult structures in vertebrates. And this is what we set out. And we did it on fishes, we do it on one species essentially. But I just show you this picture to illustrate. You see this enormous variety, the enormous differences between different species of fishes. And I think fishes, I think there are 40,000 vertebrate species nowadays, and about half of them are fishes, and the variation is biggest. You see the shape of the fins, and you see the pigment pattern, and you see the enormous differences in jaws and spots and stripes and spider. Well, you see that there is an enormous variety in these morphological patterns, and if you think about it, there is really very little known about what are the driving forces to make these differences in pattern. And if you want to know the difference, you first have to learn how the pattern are made itself. And this is our lab is setting out to, and we are focusing now on two things. We are focusing on the fins and the scales, and we are also focusing on the pigment pattern. And today I would like to restrict my talk on what we do about the pigment patterns in fish. And this is a very interesting field, because essentially what it boils down is to understand the evolution of beauty, because they are really very beautiful, and we know that they are beautiful not for us, they are beautiful for themselves, sort of for kin recognition, for sexual selection, for also of course for camouflage and escaping predators or so. But much of the patterns here is really to attract other individuals from the same species. And this is what we call beauty. So I have already mentioned that the common origin of invertebrates and vertebrates is very deep down. The bilaterian animals, the first which had a top and bottom and front and back. And the vertebrates go down to chordates, which they go down to this branch at the right side of the picture, and the split was very deep down here between the protostomy and the deuterostomy. Incidentally, what you see here, the naming of these different branches all relate to embryonic structures. Lophotrochozoans, for example, have a particular type of larva form, and this is shared between annelids and mollusks, and ecdysozoa are the animals which share that they have to molt in order to grow, and the deuterostomia they have a continuous growth, and there is a branching between echinoderms and the chordates rather late in evolution. The primitive chordates already arose together with almost all other phyla, the basic body, I mean animals of the basic body plants of the existing phyla, in the Cambrian revolution. And the chordates initially were rather primitive animals. They just had to, they shared the body plan of the chorda, which is a straight internal skeleton around which the soft body is built. And then you have these five recent classes, the fishes, amphibia, reptiles, birds, and mammals, and they get increasingly more complicated in their body organization, and they acquire all these very different structures. And this acquisition came in evolution by the sort of invention of some embryological principles, namely they acquired the neural crest and they acquired plug holes. These are embryological structures or organs which do not exist in invertebrates. And these give rise to all the different, the enormous variety of external structures which you see in the recent classes of animals. For example, all the pigment pattern, all the pigment cells are derived from the neural crest, the scales are derived from plug holes, the hairs are derived from plug holes, these are skin specializations. And this diversification, this acquisition of these rich forms are dependent on the development of the neural crest, which occurred about, I think I have a, yeah, this is the most primitive chordate. They're very simple animals, but then in later evolution they acquired first the head with the jaw and the skull, and then the legs and wings and arms, of course, and then all the external decorations like feathers and hairs and scales. So the neural crest is, I don't know, are there vertebrate embryologists among you? Maybe not. Maybe two or three. Anyway, you don't know the neural crest? No? You know. Okay. It's a structure which is, I tell you, it's a population of pluripotent cells which are highly migratory, and they arise at the juxtaposition between the epidermis and the neural involuting neural tube. And these cells then start migrating out from this region, populate the body, and give rise to all these different structures, such as peripheral nervous system, all pigment cells, the jaw, the teeth, the skull, some of the skull bones, beaks and horns, and the peripheral nervous system, etc., etc. And without these structures, the animals would look much, much, much simpler than they look nowadays. So we have to pay attention to the development of this neural crest, and it gives you, it sort of has the secret for the diversification of the forms and the morphologies of vertebrates. As I said, it originated about 450 million years ago. Incidentally, probably at the same time as the adaptive immune system developed. This might be a coincidence. But on the other hand, you have to see that the body plan, in contrast, if I go back to this primitive chordate, which just has an internal skeleton, a rod, and then a soft body out, it has to protect itself somehow. And most of the structures of the neural crest and also the skin are helping to protect the outside, the skin, and this also makes the shape, and the such as the scales and also the pigment cells, and this makes the external decoration of all the vertebrates. So the origin of the neural crest, I said it's in embryogenesis, and this is now an early stage of a zebrafish. I mean, all early stages of fishes, as you might guess, look very similar, so this is now the zebrafish. And you see here is the head, and the dotted structure is the central nervous system, and the dark structure is the chorda, the notochord, which is giving chordates the name, this rod, which is stiffening the body axis. And then you have these V-shaped somites, which are the progenitors of the muscles, which you know when you eat fishes, it looks, you can recognize it when you eat a trout, you separate the dorsal and the ventral. There's a horizontal line, which is called the horizontal myoceptum, separating both, and this is an important structure, and I'll come back to this. The neural crest arises at the top of the central nervous system, and if one looks in a cross-section, actually you can see these red cells, these are the cells from the neural crest. The dotted cells will invaginate to give the central nervous system. The dark structure beneath it is the, this is the notochord, and this is the the central nervous system and the neural crest cells, then they sort of delaminate from their origin, and then they migrate to the body, through the body. And they migrate in two different paths. One is external under the skin, and the other one is internal around the notochord and the gut. And they give rise to sensory organs, to the peripheral nervous system, to pigment cells, and to ganglia of the peripheral nervous system mostly, and to all pigment cells of the body. So the fishes are maybe the most simple form of vertebrates which we can study, and they do have a neural crest, and they have neural crest-derived organs, so this is why they are very suitable to study this. And they have other advantages, and what we use is the zebrafish. They have the advantage that they're easy to grow, and they can make big eggs, and the eggs are shed and externally fertilized. And you see here the eggs are rather big. Here you see two. And you can watch development in the living embryo with a very simple optic. Some of you might work with zebrafish. It's easy to do video images, and you can follow live imaging for a long time and observe cells migrating through the body. In particular, when you mark them with fluorescent dyes or so, then you can follow trace single cells. And I will show you some pictures about of that. This was the introduction. The outline of my talk will be that I've told you that we are setting out to identify the genes which are required to make the differences in the required to make the pigmentation pattern of the adult body and also the scales and the fins. And so we do genetic screens directly for adult morphology, and we hope to identify, to be able to identify genes which are specifically required. And then I will skip what we also do on dermal bones, namely on the scales, the skull and the fins, because of time limitations, and will tell you a little bit about how the color patterns arise in the zebrafish. So color patterns in fishes are something which you might find very fascinating. I at least love to go to the aquariums and study them. And you see that they are very, very rich in colors and also in patterns. Although when you look closely, the most common patterns are stripes and there are spots. And the stripes can be either horizontally like this in the zebrafish, or vertically, like in most of the fishes which you see here. But this is a random selection. Well, I don't know whether it's random, it's just a selection. And you see, for example, have you eaten pike? It swims in the Lake of Constance, and this is a pike here. And it also has these stripes, and when you eat it, you see the stripes on the skin. And this is a trout. You might also eat trout here from the Lake of Constance. But you see that the freshwater fishes from this area here are rather not very colorful, and the most colorful fishes are from the tropical seas, of course.
Nach einer kurzen Pause folgt der zweite Teil des Referates der Professorin Christiane Nüßlein-Vohlhardt über die morphologische Entwicklung.
Die Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
Zebrafish is not from the tropical seas, it's from the Ganges. It's a freshwater fish, and it's not so colorful, but it is colorful enough, and it has beautiful stripes. It's regularly striped. The stripes are specific to the adult pattern. The larvae are not yet striped. They are striped, but not in the same pattern. So this is just giving you an outline of the life cycle, which makes a fish an attractive model to also to study many different aspects of development. So the eggs are laid, and within two days, the embryonic development is finished, and the little larvae hatches, which by and large looks rather similar already to the fish. It swims and it can eat, and it has stripes, but it has only very primitive stripes, namely a dorsal stripe, a lateral stripe, and a ventral stripe. And then during a period at the age of about 3 to 4 weeks, the fish acquire the adult pattern in a process which we call metamorphosis, although it's by far not as dramatic as metamorphosis is in insects. And then the striping pattern remains the same, and the fish just grows continuously. And the adult fish is beautifully striped, and it has two different stripes, namely the What appears here blue, these are in fact black pigment cells which make these stripes, and in between there are yellow cells which make yellow stripes, and they appear red, blue and white because the underneath there is a layer of cells which are silvery and they reflect the light, and therefore this appears blue instead of black. So the larvae have these three black stripes, and these are obviously following morphological landmarks, whereas the adults have these stripes and they do not follow morphological landmarks. They are just regularly striped. They are oriented along the horizontal meristem, but other than that, they are very regular in distance. And it's interesting to understand how these stripes arise, because when you look, and we have done now this screen, and this is a genetic screen, and I don't want to go into detail because I think not all of you are biologists or geneticists. Making mutants means that you have to treat animals with mutagens, which cause a higher frequency of mutations in their genome, and you treat the males, and the sperm are then mutagenized, and then you create inbred families, and you cross them against each other, brother-sister matings, and then three generations or so, you can recover homozygous individuals which carry a homozygous for a particular mutation, and then you score them for phenotypes. And in our case, usually in earlier screens, we have screened the embryos, and then you can identify 25% as mutant if they show a particular trait, and then you deduce from that the parents have been heterozygous for this particular mutation. And then you can also grow them up and see whether you find adults where 25% show a particular phenotype. And this is what we did. And we isolated quite a large number of adult visible mutants where the fish survived and showed changes in their morphology. And these are the people who are involved in the screen. As you don't know any of them, I won't read them to you now. So now, again, a picture of the adult fishes. The female and the male are rather similar in pattern. The males are slightly more yellowish. The yellow cells are just show a heavier pigmentation. But the biggest difference actually is in the shape of the body, which is more rounded in the females than in the males. So you see that in this case, the pigmentation pattern is not a target of sexual selection. But it's probably, we haven't tested this, but it's obvious that these fish form schools, they swim together, they recognize each other, and they make these real large schools. And closely related fishes, well, I have already told you how the pattern is made. You see here that they're made from these three different cell types, namely the black melanophores, the yellow xanthophores, which are in between these black stripes, and then the silvery iridophores, which are underneath covering the entire body. What is interesting, though, is that there are quite a large number of danios, mainly related from the same species. What is the genus? We are closely related a species to danio, and they are not striped like silverfish. They look quite different, and they have the same cell types, but they, in this case, the danio chopra has transverse stripes, and not transverse and not longitudinal stripes. And these fishes from these two species, they mate and they produce hybrids. So they are rather closely related, but they have quite different stripe pattern. And the question we basically ask ourselves is, how do you get from here to there, and how do these stripe pattern arise? So these screens turned up a very large number of mutations. Most of them are we screened as embryonic visible mutations, so they affected also the color pattern of the larvae, but some also are specific for the stripy pattern of the adults, including Asterix, Obelix, and Leopard, which you see down here. I will show you the phenotypes later. One example of a simple color mutation or pigmentation mutation is albino, which was one of the first mutants which ever has been described in zebrafish, and it causes the melanophores to be unpigmented. And so the fish look yellow because they're only the xanthophores are pigmented and the melanophores are unpigmented, but they're striped. You see the black stripes appear as white stripes here. Can you see that? Yeah, you can just barely see it. Recently, Chris Dooley in the lab has cloned this gene and has found that it's encoding a solute carrier, which is a member of a very, very large family of proteins which are required for transport into vesicles. We don't know what it transports, but and this is for our purpose not particularly interesting, but the mutation causes the melanosomes, which are the organelles which carry the black pigment, the melanin, to be almost empty, and they have just tiny little spots of melanin, but are not filled. And there is another mutation called golden, which has just less of this melanin in these melanosomes. And in this case, the fishes are just paler than wild type. And this also encodes a solid carrier. The interesting thing about it is that the solid carrier, these two very genes have been identified in a screen for variants in human populations. Which genes vary, or where you have a particular selection of a particular allele in particular human populations. And in this case, in the case of albino, the human homologue of this gene has two alleles, and you see that one, namely the derived allele, which is noted in black, is mostly in European and near Asian populations, whereas the other tribes around the world have an ancestral allele. And incidentally, there are only three such genes which where this preference of a particular allele in particular regions of the human population have been shown, and one of is albino, the other one is golden, which I mentioned to you already. And the third one is EDAR, this is a receptor which is involved in hair formation, and in fishes it's involved in scale formation. We also have identified it in our screen, actually. And this is sort of interesting because it tells you that in this case the zebrafish has some relevance for human evolution, perhaps. It sort of is striking that of the few genes which have been implicated in human evolution, they are all also relevant for fishes. So now I come back to the origin and the development of the pigment pattern. So I mentioned already that all pigment cells are neural crest derived, and I have already shown you this picture where the neural crest cells delaminate at this particular juxtaposition between epidermis and invaginating neural plate and migrate through the body. For the larval pattern, now, and we have mutations where some of the pigment cells are lacking, and they affect the neural crest cells. And this is one of the classical mutations, colorless. It encodes a transcription factor called SOX10, and it lacks all neural crest-derived pigment cells, and these fish are totally pale, with the exception of the eye, which has pigmented cells, but these are not neural crest-derived. So it is a sort of pan-neural crest marker, and when you mark it with the DFP, and this I do not have time to explain to you, but this is mainly that you take the promoter of SOX10 and put a marker, a reporter gene for green fluorescent protein under the control of this promoter from the SOX10 gene, then you can mark all cells which express SOX10 with green. You can see the green cells are the SOX10 expressing cells, and you see these streams, segmental streams, where they sort of migrate through the body. And in a transverse section, you see that there are some migrate outwards and some migrate inwards. And the next slide should show you this when you turn the embryo around, then you can see these streams of migration, of migrating early neural crest cells. And some stay at the top. The white cells, incidentally, are marked for a gene which marks the central nervous system. It's much prettier on the screen, but those of you who are very interested in it may come and look at it. Yeah. So another marker, which actually is a gene which is expressed in all melanophores, this is called NACA, MITFA, it's also transcription factor. And there you see very nicely these streams of neural crest cells which migrate from the dorsal ridge of the nervous system throughout the body. And you see a pattern, you see that they form, in each segment they form sort of groups of cells, and these cells will later be stem cells for the pigment pattern of the adult animal. You also see something very nice, a nerve which is the glia of a nerve which is lining the lateral line, which is coming now from here. Do you see that migrating along? And this is the lateral line nerve which is pulling the glia along, and will later form the neuromust, the sensory organ for the mechano, for the water waves which the fish recognize when they swim. another a gene which we have found to be involved in pigment pattern formation is PAX7, and this is marking the xanthophores, these yellow cells. And in this case, the xanthophore precursors migrate only along the outer root and not to the inner root. And you can again use these time-lapse movies to follow these migrating pigment cells. So the larval stripes apparently arise from the differentiating neural cells, which just migrate, the neural crest cells, which just migrate to their destination and make these stripes, the lateral ventral stripe, and collect at the morphological landmarks, namely they either they stay on the crest or they collect along the lateral line or they migrate to the ventral side. The adult stripes, however, develop differently. We don't yet know exactly the time scale and also not the origin, but we know that in the time of metamorphosis, the melanophores, new melanophores, pop up. They come somehow out of the interior of the fish and align along between these stripes. And you see that here, and also at 5 weeks or so, then the xanthophore stripes appear and separate the black stripes along the horizontal mice. So there are some basic questions. So we are pretty well informed now about how the early stripes arise, but we do not know where the cells come from for the adult stripes. And there must be some stem cells, because the neural crest is long gone when the adult stripes are forming. The neural crest is a transient structure, it's no longer there. And so we have to ask the question, where are the stem cells? From where do these later pigment cells come from? And how do they migrate? And how do they arrange in this species-specific pattern underneath the skin, in stripes in the case of zebrafish and in spots in other danio species or in transverse stripes? I just want to tell you what we think what's happening, because I cannot go through all the evidences and there is not enough time for that. So we believe that the stem cells for the chromatophores collect and associate with the structures of the peripheral nervous system. This is also a neural crest derived structure. And these are located segmentally, and you have already seen in these movies that there are these dots at each segment, and they provide, and these, this, and they, and then along the lateral line, and this is sort of a grid for the different landmarks along the axis of the body of the fishes. And this is probably general for all the fishes, at least as far as we can tell, for the cypriids, which are the relatives to zebrafish. But the final stripe formation apparently depends on a subtle interaction between the cells once they are on the surface. And the evidence for that, these are these paths which I already indicated. The green ones are the precursors for the melanophores, and the red dots are the precursors of the peripheral nervous system. We find a close association between these cell types, so we believe that this is the site where the stem cells are located at the peripheral nervous system. And I skip this because I can't really illustrate it very well. This is again showing you how in metamorphosis the yellow stripe arises at the horizontal myoceptum and separates the dorsal and the ventral black stripe. So this is the first striped evidence, stripe pattern here. And we believe that the lateral line actually provides the landmark for this first stripe formation of the xanthophores. Again, evidence is difficult to explain, and I want to illustrate to you the lateral line again. And you've seen in this first movie of the MITFA, the green cells migrating along this lateral line. This is, again, another staining of the lateral line glia along the horizontal myoceptum. And then this finally leads to these sensory organs, which are located at the side of the fish and sense the mechanical stimuli and in these hair bundles, which you see sticking out of the skin. And we think that this lateral line is a marker for a morphological landmark for the origin of pigment cells. And now I show you, just for fun, a movie where you see the red staining marks the axons, the nerves which grow along the lateral line, and the glial cells are the green cells which follow this nerve. And this has been made by Darren Gilmore while he was a postdoc in my laboratory. This is just to illustrate that there is a very prominent structure along the length of the fish marking this line, and this is probably also involved in the origin of the pigmented pattern. So we have a number of adult viable mutations which affect stipe formation, and you see again here the wild type, top left. Then we have a mutant called SPARS, where you have just a rather strong reduction of the melanophores. And then we have a mutation called PFEFA, which doesn't have any xanthophores, and the mutation causes the melanophores to break up into a pepper and salt type pattern. Then we have a mutation SHADY, where you don't have iridophores, and also these fish do not have stripes. Another mutation LEOPARD, the stripes break up into spots, but we have both cell types, the xanthophores and the melanophores are present. And we have further mutations, for example, in NACAR, where the melanophores are all lacking, and this has only yellow cells and do not have very regular stripes. And these are enlargements, which I spare you because you can't really see the details. But nevertheless, the important point is that whenever one of the cell types is lacking, the other one cannot make stripes. So in this case, in the case of NACAR, we have only xanthophores, they cannot make proper stripes. And in the case of PFEFA, we have only melanophores, and also those cannot make the proper stripes. We can do an experiment, and this is easy to be done in zebrafish. You can transplant cells from a wild type into a mutant, or from a mutant A to a mutant B, and you can create chimeras where some of the cells are of a different genotype. And then you find an interesting result, namely that the stripes can be formed again. I mean, this is just to illustrate what happens when you transplant wild-type cells into an albino fish. You get these transverse rescue, meaning the donor cells make black cells, and they integrate into the stripe pattern as expected. When you transplant from a wild-type, in this case, the melanophores are colorless because it's an albino. You transplant that into a recipient which doesn't have xanthophores, then the albino xanthophores can form normal stripes in this background, meaning that there is an interaction between the melanophores and the xanthophores in order to create stripes. And we can do that with all possible combinations of cells and deduce, and this is the case where you transplant melanophores into a fish which doesn't have xanthophores, and they also at this region where the transplanted cells end up, they make proper stripes. And this indicates that a close interaction between the different cell types is required to form these stripes. And we do not know yet the molecular nature of this interaction, but this is sort of the big question which we now have in mind. And this is the experiment for the iridophores, which is difficult to see here. But if you don't have iridophores, the other cells also cannot form stripes, and you can restore the pattern by transplantation. So the conclusion is that the formation of the pattern requires an interaction of all these three cell types, and it means a short-range interaction between these cells. And we do not know which genes are involved. We have mutations where these stripes do not form regularly. I've shown you one which makes spots, and we also know, and this is the most interesting, and we have other mutations where the pattern is more or less irregular in different ways, and we are now analyzing those molecularly in order to find out which genes and proteins are involved in this interaction between these cell types. But the basic question and which we want to answer is, in fact, this is again zebrafish and two closely related species, one with highly irregular stripey pattern and then this other one with the transverse pattern. And just to conclude, we would like to know which genes are involved in these differences. And this is where I think the genetic basis of morphological evolution will find its answer, some of its some answers. Thank you for your attention. I'm sorry.
Sie hörten On the Genetic Basis of Morphological Evolution von Christiane Nüßlein-Vohlhardt vom 28. Juni dieses Jahres, gehalten auf dem Treffen der Nobelpreisträger in Lindau am Bodensee. Unsere Vorlesung der Woche können Sie am Samstag um 12.05 Uhr hören. Diesmal mit der Wiederholung des Themas »Rassische, ethnische und soziale Minderheiten als Zukunftsproblem internationaler Integrationsbestrebungen«. Von Hans-Joachim Hoffmann-Nowotny, unserer Sendung vom vergangenen Mittwoch.